Faith and the Resurrection was presented by Charlie Dewberry on August 9, 2006 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Faith and Science. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
What I'd like to do is essentially just sort of begin by telling you what I'm not going to do and why. We're going to look at some passages here. These are all dealing with the resurrection, and the issue is faith and doubt in their relationship to the response primarily of the disciples to the resurrection. And what I'm primarily going to do is point out observations now. The reason that I'm going to stick primarily with that is what Ron is doing tomorrow is talking about the nature of biblical faith. And so I don't want to get too far into what Ron's going to do. But primarily what I'm going to do is we're going to look at these verses and we're going to point out things that are going to be useful for us and in the end we need to sort of make sense of. So these are just some of those points that in the end, however we put together faith, reason, science, we at least need to filter these things through and see if they begin to fit or not fit. So, as I say, primarily what I'm going to do is we're going to just look at some specific instances and look at them and say, now, what exactly is the issue here and what's going on and is this response viewed negatively or positively, that sort of thing. So, first a couple of general comments. We began on the first day talking about the role of assumptions that you're going to bring to something and the role they play. And so, obviously, those are important in deciding what you're going to see, what you're going to understand, and how you're going to respond to it. Secondly, Jack mentioned yesterday, or maybe even the day before, about the notion that we generally take eyewitness accounts, we take them at their word and we accept them. If we don't operate that way, we're not going to know very much in life and we're just not going to get very far. So we basically accept eyewitness accounts unless there's some real reason that raises the issue to question them. So one of the first issues that usually gets raised when you start looking at the four Gospels and what it certainly appears to be a similar sort of account, but these don't line up real well at certain places. A lot of people want to point and say, aha, this stuff isn't inerrant. These are contradictory. How can you possibly put these together? It seems to me that, and there was a period in my life where that seemed pretty reasonable critique back in the day when I liked to find a bunch of evidence and push it down Christians' throats and say, how can this be true? Well, having gone to exegesis school a few years ago here, the staff raised a little different perspective about looking at those four accounts. And I don't remember exactly how they put it, but I think I can quickly make the point they were trying to make this way. If there's a court case and there's four witnesses, and it's kind of complicated what went down, and they give you a verbatim testimony of what happened, what's your reaction to that? They coached them pretty well. Isn't that kind of our response? They coached them pretty well. They're all saying the same words. They all saw exactly the same thing. Is that what we really would expect from four eyewitnesses of anything with any complexity to it at all? So it seems to me the first point to make about these four accounts, about the differences, is that's actually an interesting observation that actually suggests to me that they're actually authentic. That is what I would expect if, in fact, there are four eyewitnesses telling me complicated events. Okay, the second point is, but boy, they're saying stuff that really looks contradictory at points. So what am I going to do with that? Well, what I'm first going to do with that is I'm going to say, look, these are four different accounts. The people weren't standing in the same place at the same time. They may not have seen exactly what somebody else saw because they're not exactly in the same space. So is it possible, can I sit down with these, and is it conceivable to me that I can put together a scenario that, in fact, makes all these accounts compatible? Now, it does get tricky, because if, in fact, you come to an instance where it is not possible for two things that are described by eyewitness accounts, if that really is not possible, then I have a problem. That raises the issue of whether I'm going to accept one or more of these eyewitness accounts. So, just to say, for me, that's kind of the analytical tools I'm sort of bringing as I look at some of these. So, what I'd like to do now is let's look at some of the instances, and actually I'm not going to talk about apparent contradictions at this point. We can take that up later, because that really isn't what interests me here. What interests me here is the resurrection is not an everyday event. And, you know, it's probably the biggest event that happened to humanity in human history. Given that it's miraculous, there's going to be a pretty wide variety in responses to this. And looking at these individual instances, I think, is going to be helpful for helping us sort out the relationship between the things that interest us here, and that is, well, how reasonable is this? I mean, you know, somebody walks in and says, hey, dude rose from the dead and I saw him on the street. Well, I mean, think about that, you know. Are you going to accept that or not accept that? I mean, that's not an everyday event. And your response to that, and you're thinking through what you're going to do with an eyewitness account coming to you and telling you something extraordinary like this, this is difficult and challenging. But I think for us, it's very instructive about the relationship between reason, faith, and then it's going to connect somehow, and we'll connect it this afternoon with science and reason and science there too. So anyway, I have like 15 minutes left or so to look at a few. And there's a lot to pick from here. So I'm just going to pick a few that I think are interesting, that are the most interesting ones to look at here. So I'm going to start in Matthew, and it's the Matthew 27:55 to the end. And where I want to start, okay, the first place I want to start is in the account, is I want to start with the response of the chief priests and the Pharisees. Let's see, where is that one? Wait a minute, have I got Matthew 27? I may be jumping ahead already. 27:55. No, let me come back. Okay, I'll start with Mary Magdalene first. Okay, in all four accounts, we have the two Marys going to the tomb. The first thing to notice was they were both afraid when they noticed that the tomb was open, and an angel basically acknowledged that they were afraid. And then he tells them, he is risen, And then in the Matthew account, he says, come see the place where he was lying. Well, it's interesting to me that he didn't just say, they recognized him as an angel, and the angel said, he's risen. At that point, they could have responded, given what they know, wow, Jesus has rose from the dead, and go tell people. There is this added step of come see where he is lying. Come see the place where he was lying. I think that's significant because that's going to be part of the basis as we were talking about eyewitness accounts. Remember the example Jack pointed out. Now, did you actually see it? Well, this is telling us that that's part of the dynamic. Did you actually see it? That's a question somebody might respond when they tell them. Jesus is risen. So it seems to me that right here we see a dynamic where the angel is basically right off the bat here when the two Marys meet him, he's basically already in his answers, he's anticipating, it's anticipated sort of this natural dynamic of how eyewitness accounts work. Okay, and so what we have them doing then is okay, go tell them you will see him. So the angel is also telling them in the future you will see him. So they depart, Jesus meets him, they come up and took hold of his feet, worship him, and they go tell others. Okay. Now, what I want to do is go to Matthew 28. Now I want to go to the chief priests. Okay, this is Matthew 28:12. Why I want to go to the chief priests is this. Notice what they say. And when they had assembled with the elders and counselors together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers and said, you are to say his disciples came by night, stole him away while we were asleep. And if it should come to the governor's ear, we will win him over and keep him out of trouble. They took the money and did as they were instructed. Okay, well, what I want to highlight here is it seems to me when you look at the accounts that most of the people that were hanging around Jesus, they don't have much of an idea of what's happened, what's going to happen or what has happened. But notice the chiefs, priests, and scribes, they at least have anticipated what might, their understanding is bigger. I mean, this dude said, the scribes and Pharisees, they're saying, this guy said he's, you know, going to rise from the dead. And they're thinking, whoa, hey, if he does that, or, you know, or if somebody steals the body or something, man, we're going to be in a world of hurt. This is going to be really problematic for us. Well, it seems to me here that we see that the scribes and Pharisees have a much better understanding, at least, of the implications of these events here than virtually everybody hanging around with Jesus. But what's interesting is, of course, I mean, obviously, they don't have faith. But they at least really they understand at a much deeper level what the potential implications of what this is and what it's about. So it strikes me that that's an interesting observation here, is the fact that they have this understanding much better than most of the people hanging around with Jesus. Okay. And then in the Matthew account near the end, verse 17, with regard to the disciples. Okay, when they saw him, they worshipped him, but there was some doubt. Some were doubtful, it says in verse 17, but some were doubtful. Okay, so it's interesting here that in Matthew, that's all he says about it, that Jesus showed up, that when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some were doubtful. And that's all he says. We have no idea whether that's viewed as okay or a bad thing or a good thing? Here we have no indication at all about what Matthew's take on that is. He just says, somewhere doubtful, he just makes that observation. Okay. Okay. Now in the Mark account, let's go to Mark 16:14. Let's start with verse 11. And when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they refused to believe. And after that, he appeared in different form to two of them while they were walking along on their way into the country. And they went away and reported it to others, but they did not believe them either. Okay, so what we see here is the observation that the two Marys are beginning to report to individuals, and they're basically not believing, people are not believing the report. Now, in verse 14, and after Jesus, this is he, Jesus, appeared to the 11 as they were reclining at the table, he reproached them for their unbelief and hardness of heart because they had not believed those who had seen him after he had arisen. And he said to them, go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. What I want to highlight here is, here Jesus does rebuke them. Now, this is going to get tricky, because at least here, pretty clearly, he's rebuking them for their unbelief and their hardness of heart because they didn't believe, because they hadn't believed those who had seen him after he was arisen. So they had doubted those eyewitnesses' accounts. He's calling them to task here for not believing those eyewitness accounts. Okay, now let's go to Luke. Start in verse 24:11. And behold, the two of them were going that very day to a village named Emmaus, which was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were conversing with each other about all these things. And it came about that while they were conversing and discussing, Jesus himself approached and began traveling with them. But now the next verse. But their eyes were prevented in recognizing him. Okay, so they were prevented here from seeing who Jesus was. And Jesus said to them, what are these words that you are exchanging with one another as you are walking? And they stood looking at one another. And one of them, named Cleopas, answered and said to him, are you the only one visiting Jerusalem and unaware of the things which have happened in these days? And he said to them, what things? And they said to him, the things about Jesus, the Nazarene, who was a prophet mighty indeed in word, in sight of God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him up to the sentence of death and crucified him. But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. Indeed, beside all this, it is the third day since these things happened. But also some women among us amazed us when they were at the tomb early in the morning and did not find his body. They came saying that they had also seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. And some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it was just exactly as the women said, but him they did not see. And Jesus said to them, O foolish men and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken, wasn't it necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and enter into his glory? And then he goes on, beginning with Moses, and then Jesus goes on and he's basically rebuking them and saying, he explained to them exactly that all along here it's been explained who Jesus is going to be, that this event is going to happen. And then what we see at the end is, and then their eyes were opened and he recognized them. And what's interesting about this passage is, in this case, notice that Jesus actually makes it impossible for them, not possible for them to see that it's him. And so in a way, here, he's he's just sort of an innocent bystander just in their conversation about what's going on here. So it gives us a window, at least, into sort of their psychology and their response to what's going on. So their take was that they heard the eyewitness accounts, but they don't recognize that it's Jesus. And then Jesus is rebuking all the foolish, slow men who aren't picking up that he's the Messiah and the resurrection has happened. And so what he's really criticizing, again, it appears he's really criticizing those who don't respond with belief and understanding about what's happened here. Okay, the last one I want to go to here after this is right below this then. And so they go ahead and they relate their experience on the road and how Jesus was recognized by them in the breaking of the bread. And while they were telling these things, Jesus himself came into the midst. And while they were startled and frightened and thought that they were seeing a spirit, they said to him, "Why are you troubled and why do you, and he said to them, "Why are you troubled and why do doubts arise? See my hands, see my feet, that it is myself. Touch me, see, for a spirit doesn't have flesh and bones as you see I have." And when he showed them his hands and feet. And while they stood, and while they still could not believe it, they were joying and marveling over it. So even in this case, some of them actually saw him, touched, and still couldn't really actually believe it. And in later in Luke, he points out that you are the witnesses that in verse 48, his point is that in fact, that they are in fact the witnesses, their eyewitness accounts, that should be sufficient, that they are the witnesses, and that is the grounds that they have to authenticate the resurrection. And now what I'd like to do, because I'm running out of time, is just do two things quickly. One is the account in John of Thomas. It's 20:24-29. But Thomas, one of the 12 called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. And the other disciples therefore were saying to him, "We've seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the imprint of nails and put my finger into the place of the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." And after 8 days, again his disciples were inside and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the door having been shut, stood in their midst and said, "Peace be with you." And he said to Thomas, "Reach here your finger, see my hands, reach here your hand and put it into my side and be not unbelieving, but believing." Thomas answered him and said, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who do not see and yet believe." Well, the first question is here, a number of people take this that Thomas's doubt was actually really negative, that we should read this, that actually Jesus is kind of rebuking him for not recognizing him just on the base of the evidence, and rebuking him for the fact that he didn't believe until he actually seed and touched Jesus. It seems to me that's kind of a difficult argument to make from this passage. One of the keys, however, is, though, how you are going to read sort of the tone in Jesus' voice here. Is it possible to read it in a tone that is negative? Well, there is some possibility, but it's not strong. It's not a strong possibility, especially when there is the other option that's here that's really just as viable. And that is that Jesus actually doesn't rebuke him here, which is actually interesting. Why in one case is he rebuking people for not believing based on the eyewitness accounts, but yet here it doesn't look like he's rebuking him for saying, "Well, it was all right, you didn't believe until you had your own experience, your own eyewitness experience with this." So it seems to me that we see both sorts of situations happen with regard to the accounts here and Jesus' response to people with regard to the resurrection. Now, on one hand, he's saying, you should have bought the eyewitness accounts, and in that was a mistake. But on the other hand, he's not rebuking everybody who didn't. I mean, it looks to me as if he's not really rebuking Thomas here. And then we have the statement at the end, because you've seen me, you believed. Blessed are those who did not see and yet believed. Well, what's that about? And it seems to me his point is that, as we were talking about earlier, that it's harder to believe if you weren't actually an eyewitness account of this thing. That the people who weren't the eyewitness accounts, you're one step removed from the actual experience of it. You're having to take other people's word for it. And it seems to me what he's saying is that's a much harder step. And the last passage I'll deal with real briefly, because we're all ready to go to lunch, is in 1 Corinthians when Paul is interacting with the Corinthians, and some of them were arguing that the resurrection had not occurred. And what I want to highlight here in chapter 15, 1 through 19, is near the end of that, where Paul is basically saying that if there was no resurrection of the dead, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ hasn't been raised, then our preaching is in vain, your faith is in vain. Moreover, we are even found to be false witnesses of God, because we witness against God that he raised Christ, whom he did not raise, if in fact the dead were not raised. For if the dead are not raised, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ hasn't been raised, your faith is worthless. You are still in sin. Then those also who have fallen asleep in Christ have perished. If we have hoped in Christ in this day only, we are of all men the most to be pitied. It seems to me, and just the one thing I want to highlight in this verse is Paul is basically saying, look, these eyewitnesses' accounts, if this event really did not happen, if these eyewitnesses are telling you something that really didn't happen, then your faith is nothing. It's a lie. Because if these eyewitness accounts are actually false, then the whole thing is a lie. There's essentially no justification at all for believing that, in fact, Jesus is the resurrection and the gospel is the truth. So, in Paul's mind at least, that would nullify the claim and justification, the very ground of their faith. And I'll stop at that point, and we'll come back to it this afternoon. Yeah.